What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast number 314, Demonstrating Decreased Liability, Justifying the Cost. This week, our special guest is Scott Galloway out of DeSoto. And then we have the always interesting Dr. Josh Yellen. Dr. Yellen, I want you to tell me about the Matrix Rabbit.
All right, so here's the story about the Matrix Rabbit. It took me a second to figure out what you were talking about. Who told you about the Matrix Rabbit?
It was Knobloch.
So here's a little background. Is that I am a city boy from Los Angeles, and I had never been out hunting in my life, right? Hunting to me is that I've gone to a couple different grocery stores, and, you know, I didn't find the ground beef I wanted, so I, rather than going to Albertsons, I went to Ralph's. That's my version of hunting. So when I hired Dr. Knobloch, to be our clinical coordinator. I also found out that one of our recent hires, Dr. Gray, was also a hunter. Dr. Knobloch grew up hunting in a small town in Kansas, and his dad was a butcher. So, like, if you were going to eat a nice meal that night, more than likely, you probably shot the animal and butchered it, and this is what you're eating. So I decided that, you know what, I had never been out hunting, and I at least wanted to give it a shot. So what better way than try to bond with, you know, my clinical coordinator and our new faculty member, Dr. Gray. So Dr. Gray at the time had a lease. So we woke up early in the morning and drove out and, you know, went to the lease. And I was like a fish out of water, man. I just did not fit. And we got up to the deer blind and, you know, I'm answering emails, trying to build the program, you know, bing, bing, bing. And Knobloch looks at me, what are you doing, man? I said, what are we waiting for? You guys are just staring out of this box, you know, with a couple guns. Like, what? We're waiting for the deer. You see any deer around here, man? He says, no, you got to be quiet or you're going to scare them. Like, this is the same animal that, jumps out on the road and gets hit by a car. It's not the smartest animal in the world. So a few, you know, experiences went by. We hunted in the morning. We hunted in the evening, you know. He killed a couple hogs. I heard them squeal. You know, he said we had to cull the hogs. And I couldn't figure out what he was saying, cull the hogs. I'm like, what are we going to call them? Like, oh, is there a way that, is it like, what is it, the University of Arkansas Razorback? I don't know what we're doing. And so I had that experience. And the next day I just decided that I want the experience of being able to hunt an animal, kill it, and eat it. So we went back out to the deer blind, and sure enough, this rabbit appears out of the brush. And the rabbit is just eating, and Dr. Knobloch gives me, he's got an AR-15. I had never held a gun like that before. And says, here, take this. And, you know, he's got the sight on it. You know, look at the green dot. And when the green dot, I think, turns red, I don't remember. That's when you know it's lined up. And Dr. Gray is in back of me with the binoculars, like, you know, he's spotting me. He says, all right, man, you got it? I said, yeah, I think I got it. He goes, all right, let him have it. So I squeeze one off, and this bullet whizzes by the rabbit. Poof, up goes some dust. And the rabbit kind of looked behind. Oh, yeah. Kept eating. So Knobloch says, hit him again. So I squeeze maybe one or two more off. Poof, poof, dust. Poof, poof. The rabbit finally, I think, gets wise and looks around. It's like, all right, I'm getting shot at. I'm out of here. So he goes back in the brush. I'm like, all right, well, we're not, you know, this isn't going to work. A couple minutes later, the same rabbit came out, but now had a little bit of a swagger with him. You know, like, dude, I'm bulletproof. You can't touch me. It comes back out, and Knobloch says, unload the clip. And so I did. I unloaded this clip. I mean, shells are flying everywhere. Cactus got mowed down, plants are dying, dust is everywhere. Everything settles, and that rabbit is still there eating. That's the story of the Matrix Rabbit. And I told him, I said, look, where I'm from, Los Angeles, we used guns to kill each other. We didn't use guns to kill animals, you know, so I knew if that car is going 30 miles an hour, you know, and that gun's pointed just the right way, I'm dead shot, but out of no way. So that's the story of the Matrix Rabbit.
All right, so just a little fun with Dr. Yellen there.
Thank you.
So,
I'm not a hunter. I'm a city. I was born and raised in the city, the concrete jungle. That's where I'm from.
I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right beside me, we've got
Kevin,
Jaylene,
Liz,
Ben,
Jose.
And Jose, my students joining us for the podcast, a great part of what we're doing today. If you want to join our conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/decreased liability. So again, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/decreased liability. So the whole theme of this episode is Scott has 7 staff athletic trainers there at DeSoto High School.
Wow.
I want our district to provide adequate care to our middle school athletes, because my brother-in-law coaches at one of the middle schools, and you know, we've had conversations about, you know, the injuries, broken bones, clavicles, concussions, and they're not really equipped to manage those. And so I want to move our district towards providing better care for those athletes. So why not talk to the expert, Scott Galloway, about how to kind of win over your school board and improve your situation and provide better athletic care for the middle school athletes. So, Scott, I said all that correctly, right? 7 athletic trainers at DeSoto?
Yeah, you know, we're a 1 high school district, so it's got advantages. But yeah, so we have 7 full-time athletic trainers, and now 3 of those are housed full-time at 3 different middle schools during the day. But, you know, we collaborate, you know, across all those campuses to work together.
So, Scott, let me ask you a question. That's 7 full-time athletic trainers on one at one location, or that's for the district, or?
So it's technically for the district. So I have 4 full-time that are housed at the high school, and we have 3 middle schools. So I placed 1 staff member at each middle school. However, you know, we meet together as a staff in the mornings. You know, when we have Friday night football, you know, there'll be anywhere from 4 to 7 of us there. When we have larger events, you know, that it's not like they're only assigned. It's kind of like, I would kind of akin it to the university models, to where you have, you know, you have staff members that are assigned to particular sports, you know, and then when you have large events on the campus, they collaborate. It's kind of what we do, except, you know, in our case at the high school, let's say we have 1,500, or it's really closer to about 1,200 athletes. Those 4 athletic trainers are each assigned to some individualized sports that they are responsible for. Mm-hmm. Well, each middle school has approximately 200 to 300 athletes, depending on the campus. And so that's almost like having 2 or 3 sport assignments at the high school, right? So, you know, they each have their group of athletes they're responsible for, but we all work together.
And so, you know, just so I can wrap my mind around it and the people that are listening. So your district is composed of 1 high school?
Correct.
And 3 middle schools?
Correct.
Okay. And your high school is a 5A?
6A.
6A, so there's a lot of students.
Yeah. No, we're a smaller 6A, so we have about 2,900 students. So to give you an example, Allen High School up the road has about 6,000 students.
Wow.
Duncanville, for example, this year when we make the playoffs in football, we'll go 6A Division II. Mm-hmm. So we're not one of the, you know, there's schools larger than us in our district. There's a few schools smaller than us. There's definitely larger campuses. And this new Super 6A they're proposing, we would not be in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Just trying to.
Yeah, that's great. We want to definitely understand the situation there.
Yeah, just trying to figure it out.
Here in Pasadena ISD, we have 5 high schools, 10 middle schools. So we currently have 11 athletic trainers in our district.
Sure.
And so
5 high schools, 10 middle schools, and how many ATs?
There's 11. So there's 2 at each high school plus Randy at the district level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, ideally we would have 1 at each middle school, but we're going to get to all that later.
Mm-hmm.
So Josh is also a member of the Professional Responsibility Committee. So he's a really good person to talk to here about liability. So Josh, can you give me a definition of liability?
Yeah, boy, that's a good question. What is the definition of liability? So let's kind of reverse engineer that, I think, and talk about, you know, how do we mitigate liability? So liability, in my opinion, is this ability to take on the responsibility to really, in a medical profession, follow best practices, right? We have liability insurance. Hopefully everybody, all practicing athletic trainers, have got that. A $1 million, $3 million policy, you know, that kind of stuff. And that liability insurance there is that in case an accident happens that you're not found negligent for, and we'll talk about negligence here in a second, that monetarily the patient, you know, if there's a lawsuit brought, or, you know, if there's some sort of fine, that insurance covers you. So how do you mitigate or how do you decrease the risk of liability? Well, I think that's a matter of following best practices. And let's just start off by saying that the NATA has a code of ethics. The BOC has professional practice standards. Even in athletic training education, the CADE has got accreditation standards. Each state, with the exception of California, because they're not state credentialed yet, they have their own practice acts. And so it cannot be stressed enough that practicing athletic trainers understand the NATA code of ethics, the BOC practice standards, and the state practice acts in the state that they reside, because there are different nuances to each. Like, for instance, in the state of Texas, we fall under physician delegation. What does that mean? That means that if, you know, obviously we're working under the direct supervision of a physician, and if an athletic trainer's gone through the proper training, dry needling course, Graston course, those types of things, if that athletic trainer has gone through extra certifications, the OTC certification, orthopedic technologist, they have extra training as far as a residency program, then that athletic trainer is being used in a different capacity than, say, Scott's being used or that you're being used, right? Or even some of the athletic trainers that we work with at UH or Rice or all these different, right? That state practice act may be different than what you see in Louisiana. It may be different than what you see in North Carolina. It may be different than what you see in Arizona. So you have to understand all of that. So that's really what liability is. Liability is the ability to make sure that we're following best practices and that we understand all the laws. And this is something that I'm still having so much trouble wrapping my head around. We have, and I'm happy to say it, we have a very good relationship with Cornish Medical. Butch and his team, they do a great job of calibrating all of our therapeutic modalities. We use them for all of our clinical affiliation sites. I won't go to anybody else because I know that if I put it out to Butch or Blake or anybody else, they're going to do it right. And then if I need, you know, evidence that this has been calibrated, I'll get it. Because in my world, it's a CADE standard. I think it's CADE standard, like number 71 or 72 or something like that. But I hear stories all the time of athletic trainers at various sites who don't have their modalities calibrated on a yearly basis. You're setting yourself up for a liability issue. This is negligence. And there are so many athletic trainers that don't understand where that law comes from. That's an OSHA standard. And it in the eyes of the law, your athletic training room, whether it's Scott's or whether it's Jeremy's, is no different than the PT clinic, than the physician's office, than, you know, any other medical facility. And the fact that this is allowed to happen and it's not being regulated more by us as a profession, I don't even know how to respond to it. You know, my first answer is that I think we have an obligation. It may sound harsh, but if I'm a practicing athletic trainer and I know another athletic trainer is OSHA non-compliant, I report him. The reason why is because if I know that somebody is practicing, we'll call that negligently, by law, if I don't report it, I'm just as culpable. So all of that goes into liability, right? The one thing that Scott said to me, I'm amazed by it. 7 full-time athletic trainers for 1 high school and 3 middle schools. Is that right, Scott?
That's correct.
And so the NATA, right? And whenever I talk to colleges about it, the NCAA handbook, the sports medicine handbook, when they reference the amount of athletic trainers for student athletes, they reference the NATA's guidelines on the appropriate medical care for a secondary school athlete or the appropriate medical care for intercollegiate athletics. That's the algorithm they go to. And whenever I hear athletic trainer, I didn't know about that algorithm. Come on, man. Really? That shame on them. We're not following best practices. We are increasing our liability.
Scott, you have demonstrated the need for additional athletic trainers for additional care by demonstrating that you as an athletic trainer and you as a staff have decreased the overall cost, the liability, the responsibility on the district. What does that look like for the district? What are they liable for?
Anytime you have a catastrophic event on your campus, that's kind of an automatic attention to liability. So in 2002, we had a student athlete death on campus. That was kind of the beginning of, not that we didn't have awareness or were raising awareness. That was kind of the beginning of how we began to show the need for decreased liability in our district. With that being said, the positions we have today were not created because of that incident. We have a whole new set. I'm the longest tenured member of probably the district upper administration that exists here. You know, the people who hired and approved these positions were not here in 2002, and we're not aware of that incident. You know what I mean? So a lot of people look at us and say, well, it's because of this that you have, it's because of X that you have Y. And that's really not the case, but it, I'm always able to use that as part of my justification. You know what I'm saying? When you go to make an ask for something, you're able to either A, tell some people the story and give them the opportunity to remember, you know, or if they have, if they were unaware, we're able to educate them on, hey, here are the, here's the worst possible case scenario when it comes to liability. We were sued for $18 million. It went to the United States Supreme Court of Appeals. Wow. You know, it took us several years to get through that, but that's in 2002. This is 2017. You know, when I went to propose these new positions, this is my fifth superintendent since that time. So it's not like there's a big connection. It's just, I always remember that. I will always remember that day. And so for me, I look at things through different glasses. You know, I look at everything I do based on that scenario. And then I think that's what helps me try to improve our situation here locally.
Scott, obviously, I think the statute of limitations of you being able to speak about this case have passed. Sure. Do you feel comfortable?
No, absolutely.
You know, speak. So can you kind of give the audience a little bit more background? A horrible event, student athlete dies on campus. Is that right?
Sure. So we had a girls basketball player that was a freshman. They were outside first week of school doing a timed 2 mile run, which is something that, you know, they just, that was part of their training regimen. Athlete presented in the athletic training room with typical symptoms of similar to heat exhaustion. You know, she was conscious, breathing, you know, we discussed what she'd had for breakfast. She was, you know, she was sweating, but, you know, she was very lethargic. And just over a period of 5 to 10 minutes, her condition began to worsen. We ended up calling 911. She went unconscious. We did CPR and she ended up not making it. Come to find out 6 weeks later, she died of sudden cardiac arrest associated with physical exertion due to sickle cell trait. And so that kind of began my ambassadorship, so to speak, with sickle cell trait, sudden death, and physical activity. And so I got involved with Scott Anderson at the University of Oklahoma, Randy Eichner, who at that time was their team internist physician, and I was part of the NATA's position statement in 07 regarding sickle cell trait and sudden death. And I've really spent the majority of my career traveling the country as an advocate for that, not just through the NATA, but I've done some grassroots community education in the Florida Everglades where this runs rampant. You know, it's not just in schools that education needs to take place. It's community groups and primary care offices, and, you know, community sickle cell organizations. And so over time, because of my involvement in advocacy for that and other, you know, that kind of leads, when you've been a part of that, it kind of leads you down the path of decreased liability, increased care, better awareness. And that's just the glasses that I look at any decision I'm going to make regards to the profession at this level and really any level. When I worked in the hospital system for a couple of years and trying to help even community sport organizations see the need for athletic trainers, you can share that type of story, right? And so that's the way I see the profession, is through those glasses. I think that's the way we all, if we're going to grow, have to start. I think there's decreased liability and increased value, and I think those are two totally different conversations. And in my case, while decreased liability is important, and based on our history, as you can tell, it's important. The people that I, you know, the people that were a part of that 15 years ago have been gone for 10 years. So for me, so if you've not had a personal experience with an incident like that, you don't fully sometimes understand the idea of liability. You don't understand being deposed, you know what I'm saying, by an attorney. You don't, you've not, you know, if you Google my name, you'll, you know, the lawsuit will come up in court records, you know, I mean, it's,
so let me ask you a question. I'm assuming at that time, sickle cell was not a part of the PPE.
Correct. I had that added. I approached the UIL the year after that and had that question added to the UIL's right. PPE questionnaire.
And then I'm also assuming, knowing you, that you know AEDs were in place and they were calibrated, operating appropriately, et cetera.
Correct.
And so the lawsuit was brought based on the fact that it was not in the PPE?
No, the lawsuit was basically they were going to have to prove deliberate indifference. So In their mind, we did not respond to her either A, in a timely manner, right. B, the root of this case was this. She had electromechanical dissociation or PEA, pulseless electrical activity in her heart. So there was no indication for usage of an AED. She had normal electrical rhythm, but no mechanical heartbeat. Mm-hmm. So therefore an AED would not have helped her. However, and as we know now, which is standard of care for treating, you know, kids with an exertional sickling crisis, is the use of high flow oxygen. Mm-hmm. And we did not have high flow oxygen at the time. And for the record, probably 75% of secondary schools still don't. However, you know, she had experts to testify to the fact that if we would have had that, you know, we could have potentially saved her life. Now, granted, we would have needed the oxygen and needed to know that she had sickle cell trait. So she did not know she had the trait. Her parents did not know she had the trait. Matter of fact, I don't know that Dad knew that he had the trait. You know what I'm saying? So there was a lot of things that were revealed throughout the process of the case. But that was really, you know, at the end of the day, when there's a death and a family, you know, people want answers. People want somebody to pay. If I was a parent, I would want to believe that, you know, and I used to fight that. I used to say, well, no, we did all we could, or there's nothing we could have ever done. But looking back, I tell groups now all the time that if I would have known, there's a lot of things here. If I would have known she had the trait, if I would have been better educated early in my career about what is sickle cell trait and what does it look like and how do we identify those kids and treat them accordingly? And if I would have been prepared with oxygen and, you know, if all of those things would have been true, I do think we could have potentially saved her life, you know, because I do think it's preventable, because based on the changes that we've made, we've not seen near the complications with trait and exertion in school districts who respond appropriately.
And so the question I have for you is that it's a part of the PPE now, and through that PPE and the vetting process, have you discovered more students with the trait? So the question I have is, has the prevalence or the incidences of trait stayed the same, or because you've added this to the PPE, you've been able to identify, you know, and mitigate possible liability issues?
Right. So we definitely mitigate liability by asking the question. However, just because you ask the question doesn't always mean you get the answer.
Right.
And so that's why testing is so important. And that's why the NCAA has been so adamant, and the NATA, about in absence of knowledge of your status, you need to be screened so that we can have the information. And at this level in secondary schools, you know, we haven't mandated screening, but we do know that all 50 states screen at birth. And especially over the past 15 years. So the information is out there. It's a matter of gathering that information. And so there's a disconnect between primary care physician, you know, and newborn screening and how that message is communicated to families. We have kids who answer the question. So we went to some online, you know, documentation the past couple of years. And I asked the question, and I'm able to filter our data now. Have you ever been told, you know, I ask about what their status is. Do you know, do you have sickle cell trait? Yes, no, or unknown. And I put unknown there so that I can see how many families, because we're predominantly an African-American community here. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be African-American to have the trait. I just had communication from a parent from North Carolina just last week. Her son died, and he's Caucasian. And so we know with cross-cultural marriages and things, you know, we're a melting pot now here in America, that these, you know, things are not going to be race-based when it comes to these conditions. However, you know, I have 180 people answered the question that I don't know what my status is. And so we use that as an opportunity to make phone calls and educate the importance of finding out what your status is.
And in, you know, and in your case, Scott, you come across a situation where a patient is you know, identified as unknown trait. Does your district facilitate the testing?
We don't currently facilitate the testing because it was done at birth. I asked them to either A, go back to their PCP or their newborn screen, or B, request those records from the Department of Health, State Health Services.
And are they cleared for participation without that information?
Yes. Yeah, they're cleared for participation without that information, only because, you know, that is, their physician has cleared them based on their medical history. You know what I'm saying?
I suppose I don't want to play devil's advocate, but I'm going to. So in the case that you're bringing up in 2002, this student athlete.
Sorry, I went off.
It's really funny. All of a sudden you just see him. Yeah. In the case of this athlete in 2002, she was also cleared by her physician.
Absolutely.
Okay. So help me understand a little bit more about, in one case, you have an athlete that was cleared by a physician and the trait was unknown, right?
Sure.
And in 2016, you have another athlete that's cleared by a physician and the trait is unknown.
Okay.
So what, and there's no consequence, right? You can still be cleared for participation, all those other things. So what makes the scenarios different? Is it your ability? You've updated your emergency action plans. You've got O2 on board. You've got all these other things in case it does happen.
For me, it's our ability. So having the knowledge allows me to respond with specific treatment protocol for that kid. So, you know, just like when a kid has asthma and we know they have asthma and they have a problem, you know, we know that kid probably needs his rescue inhaler, you know, or let's say we know they have diabetes and they potentially are on insulin, whatever it may be, or they need a snack or whatever. I don't see those as much different. Now, we also recognize that there's going to be kids who say yes that are not, or who say no that are, you sure. know, and because we are prepared, we err on the side of, you know, there's no harm, no foul for, you know, giving a kid some oxygen, you know right. what I'm saying? You know, none of our kids have COPD, we hope. And so,
let's hope not.
You know, in our case, it's just a part of our EAP now. If we have a kid who's struggling, that's part of what we do is administer oxygen. If a kid's ever unconscious, we're going to do that and administer an AED. You know, if we're going to apply an AED, we're going to apply oxygen. And it's just, you know, based on our experience, that's why we handle it the way we do.
And so talk a little bit about, you all have 7 athletic trainers.
Right.
You have a functioning student aid program.
Correct.
And so tell me a little bit about your communication between the athletic trainers, the student aid program, EMS in the area, your physicians. How are you communicating all of this as you're updating these EAPs to all these various entities? Because, you know, one of the things when we talk about mitigating liability, mitigating risk, you know, 99% of this is going to come down to effective and efficient communication. So we're all on the same page. So how do you go through that?
So, in addition to having the staff, I am lucky that each of our staff members are non-instructional employees. So they are all.
So they're all administrative contracts.
Yes.
Okay.
They're all considered campus administrators. They do not have an academic assignment outside of, you know, our athletic training students that we have some designated times for. But in general, it allows us the opportunity to effectively meet, communicate, collaborate. You know, twice a week we meet as a staff of 7, you know, in my office to discuss all of those things. You know, we're the high school staff are 12-month employees. The middle school staff are 11-month employees. And so we get extra time during the summer. And whether or not we were employed or not, we'd be spending the time because that would be at my, my discretion probably. But you know, we spend the time to cover all that. So like this summer, you know, we spent the time covering all of the EAPs at each campus. And those are things we already had in place, because when there were four of us, each of my assistants were assigned a middle school they were responsible for when it came to just communication, paperwork, evaluation. They would go over once a day in the morning and hold a 1 hour injury clinic to kind of just help with that process of just what you say, mitigating risk or decreasing liability. Because we know coaches are not, that's not their job, even though they perform that job, especially at the middle school level. If they're doing it, they're doing it ineffectively, and more than likely, they're doing it, they're not wanting to do that either. You know what I'm saying? You're having to drag them to do it. I don't blame them. You know, it's not their
role. Yeah, it's not their primary role, right? I mean, even if they go through a first aid and CPR course, that's not what their job is to do. So let's go back to the administrative contract. This is another thing that I always have trouble wrapping my head around. Whenever I ask athletic trainers, especially those athletic trainers that are practicing in the high school setting, I ask them, what's your contract? Are you on a, you know, instructional contract and you're given a stipend, or are you on an administrative contract? I'm always shocked by how many people don't know that. And so for you, you're on an administrative contract. You're at 200 and how many days?
226.
Yeah, you're at 226. And so this scenario of being on an administrative contract really is one of those things that we look at. If we look at other healthcare providers that interact with the schools, occupational therapists, physical therapists, school nurses, those types of, you know, healthcare providers, none of them are on instructional contracts. We're also right. A healthcare provider. We should not be on an instructional contract. We should be administrative. And that's a conversation that happens between, you know, the athletic trainer and the principal of the school, the athletic trainer and the superintendent. And, you know, it's one of those things whenever I hear athletic trainers, what's happening at a high school, what it's happening at a college, you know, that athletic trainer administratively is probably going to answer to the athletic director. But in all reality, if you're on an administrative contract, regardless of administrative instruction, your answer to the principal of the school. And, you know, those conversations, I applaud you, you know, that you have this set up.
So, Scott, when you started at DeSoto, were you administrative, or is that a change that you had made?
No, that's a change. So when I started in 1999, there were two of us. We both taught classes every day. It was a typical, you know, I had a 900-square-foot athletic training facility. It was, by and large, what most people operate in. It's just we began the process of, people don't like me because I, every year I'm asking for something new, right? But that's just my philosophy. You know,
we're Scott, not getting better. Change is hard. And what I'm hearing is that you're an agent of change and people don't like that.
Yeah, no, they don't.
They don't. They don't like the people that are progressive, and they don't like the people that, and I don't say progressive in a political sense. They don't like people that are progressive and that are constantly pushing for change. Yeah. That's the only way that the profession is going to grow.
Yeah, and here's what I've learned over the years, and especially adding these positions, is I've kind of changed. You know, I used to be all about liability and working conditions and pay and everything that athletic trainers want, which is they want more money, they want better schedule, they want more time, and all those things are important. But from the outside looking in, they're also very self-serving. Now, granted, I totally agree that those things are necessary. But one of the things I learned when I went to work in the hospital system for a while, I went and got my MBA in healthcare administration. And because I really thought that was an area I would excel in because of the way I approach things. You know, I began to think, man, I've got four athletic trainers. I have a 5,000 square foot training room. I have all these things. Maybe I'm done in secondary school. So I went to the hospital world where I learned about value. And I learned about return on investment mm-hmm. and, you know, how, you know, being attributing worth to something, you know. And so when I came back to the school setting, I realized that's what athletic trainers are missing mm-hmm. is this sense of business, this sense of, you know, being a self-starter, marketing for yourself, learning how to approach situations with, you know, adding value. And within a year of coming back here, I was able to add three positions. It's not because it's DeSoto. It's because of the way I think you approach the situation. And so in this case, I took the approach of what do athletic trainers, what kind of value can we bring to the organization? Not just, and decreased liability is one of them, but there are a lot of value adds that the athletic trainer brings based on the personality that's sitting in the chair, mind you. You know what I'm saying? This past right. Monday, I cooked 300 pounds of meat for our football team and served them after the, you know, after practice. You know, that's a value add for a lot of people, right? But so I approached each of these middle school principals. We had added middle school soccer, which we had not had. We were missing, you know, the relational component on campus. We were missing the return to academic piece for concussion. And I just felt like it was a great time with me being new and them not hearing from me for, because I was gone for 2 years and I came right back. Oh, maybe they need to hear from me again on that I need something, you know? And so I created a proposal and met with each of these principals and they signed their endorsement. So now when I went to propose these FTEs, this wasn't the athletic trainer crying about he works too much or there's too many hours or there's not enough money, or it wasn't just about the kids need better care. It was, look, here are the things that this FTE brings to this campus and to you as a principal, not just about athletics, but we can be a campus leader, presence in the hallway, introducing kids to a new career path. We can help with decreased time loss for your faculty because mm-hmm. we can help them develop, you know, some personal, yeah. Are there things that we give away as athletic trainers, like seeing faculty, and, you know, faculty pays a copay when they go to the physical therapist. Well, they come to us and it's free, but.
Well, and let me tell you something too. I think that there's, you know, to be honest with you, I think there's an obligation to be, and I, you know, to say that you're giving something away, I don't think you are. I think every time that you have a chance to see a patient that's outside of your typical, you know, patient body, I suppose, it's another opportunity for you to market and promote your skills.
Right.
And you brought up something really interesting before. It was about the ability to understand the business of the profession. I cannot agree with you more that one of the areas that I think that we really lack is we don't understand the business of what we do. And so, you know, obviously, you had an interest in this. You went on and got your MBA, and I applaud you for that. That was one of the reasons why I went on and I got my doctorate in educational leadership, is because I needed to understand the business of what education right. was. And how do we use things, and how do we use words like leverage? How do we use words like influence, return on investment? And one of the things that I think that we need to do a better job of in the profession is making sure that everybody knows the definition of an athletic trainer and everybody knows the scopes of practice. Because when you're going to market and promote your skills, and everybody's going to get this question, well, what's the difference between an athletic trainer and physical therapist? What's the difference between an athletic trainer and occupational therapist? What's the difference between an athletic trainer and PA, athletic trainer and a chiropractor? But the most common question that I receive is, well, what's the main difference between an AT and a PT? I'm happy to explain the difference. It comes down to, here's our definition. Here's our scope of practice. Here are our practice domains. Here's what we do. Here's what a PT does. Here's our entry-level education. Here's a PT's entry-level education. Here's where we are similar. Here's where we are different. And that comes down, Scott, to marketing and branding and being able to promote this. So that's great. I love it.
All right. So what I'm understanding so far is when I first started this, we were collecting hours. And I mentioned to Kathy Supat down here, and I said, you know, hey, everybody, collect your hours so we can kind of talk to the admin about, you know, adding another position or doing something at least part time for the junior highs. She's like, they don't really care about the hours. You sign the contract, they don't really care. What they do care about is the liability. And so then that began me on this conversation where I'm doing a series of interviews about liability and how do we get middle school athletic trainers and that kind of thing. And then what I'm hearing you say is kind of similar to what Shattuck down here says, and that's, how can you add value? How can you make it better? And so I shouldn't focus on decreasing liability so much, but how can I add value to that middle school, you know? And so is that kind of, that's what I'm understanding, right?
No, it is. I think decreasing liability is a part of adding value. Okay. I think the overarching theme is adding value, and I think decreased liability. So it all depends on, so the way I look at this is you have many stakeholders, right? And so the goal is to win is to identify who all goes into making this decision, right? Obviously, if it's going to be at a middle school, that campus principal who controls that budget and ultimately has to make the request for FTEs, that's got to be your first win, you know, and then maybe that has to be routed through your athletic director, you know, or whoever your supervisor is. But so you have to figure out, you know, the value. What does that principal need to see the value? You know, what kind of value does that principal need? Because that's going to be different than maybe the person in HR or the assistant soup who is looking out for liability. You know, so a principal probably cares less about liability than they do about controlling their lunchroom. You know what I'm saying? Or kids being in school and having good attendance, because you get funded based on your mm-hmm. attendance, right? Mm-hmm. And so by having an athletic trainer, now these kids aren't leaving school to go to physical therapy. They're not necessarily leaving school to go to the physician, because you are reducing the amount of time loss that kids are out of school. So therefore, when they do their attendance count second period and they turn in a higher number, they're getting funded at a higher rate and it looks better for their campus. And so you kind of have to identify, hey, what are the hot buttons that me as an athletic trainer can help you with on your campus? And that may look different. When I go talk to our risk management people, you bet I'm going to talk about liability and all of that. But principals, you know, the truth is school districts are very protected with Texas law when it comes to liability. You really have to do something bad if you work for a school district to be sued and to be defeated, because you're so protected. Now, personally, as an athletic trainer, you know, those conversations are a little bit different. But typically, when you get sued in a public school system, and I speak from experience, your school, you fall under that school district umbrella, and their attorneys kind of cover you, and tort law and all that stuff covers you. And so, yeah, that would be my encouragement to you is, you know, when I went from two athletic trainers to three, and then from three to four, and we expanded our facility three times and then built a new one, a lot of that was based on, I did the same thing. I logged my hours and days. I divided my salary by the number of hours and gave them an hourly rate. And I started down that road, and it did work for a while, but it was all about me. You know what I'm saying? And in today's, you know, the way I feel like we accomplish great things here, you know, I just bought 10 recovery pump units. I don't know if you've heard of recovery pump, but similar to the Normatec. You know, we just bought 10 of these units. We have this big recovery room. You know, I'd give you a video tour, but it's busy.
How much that cost you?
That was about 15 grand. You know what I'm saying? But
see, I don't want to interrupt Scott here, but this is why it's so important to understand the business, right? To have somebody like Scott in place, to understand the business, right? To generate funds, fiduciary management, organizational leadership, organizational structure, communication. This is Scott, what you represent is the future of leadership in athletic training, where it was before, you know, the head athletic trainer was taping ankles and, you know, and I'm sure you're still doing all those other things, injury evaluation, concussion evaluations, all those other things. But it's the topography of the profession at this level has changed. And we need to do a better job of educating the people that are coming out of school, right? Educating young clinicians on exactly what Scott's talking about, right?
We show that, you know, just that purchase, it's been about the kids. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's been about either the value for the district, or what are we doing that's helping kids? You know, because it's hard for somebody to argue with you. You know, when I asked, you know, the assistant superintendent, well, why are these 13 and 14 year old kids, why do they deserve less care than, you know, or a substandard of care? Sorry, as I'm waving to you. Substandard care as compared to the 16, 17 year old kids. You know, do you want your middle school kid? You know what I'm saying? You know, we're all competing, especially in a world now where we have charter schools. We have private schools competing for kids. Mm-hmm. Some of that's job security for administrators. And so you got to be able to kind of speak that language and talk that talk. And there's lots of other ways, you know, career technology education, there's lots of federal funding involved. You start tying positions to teaching positions. You know, I'm lucky here that they've bought into this idea that the athletic trainer is the athletic trainer. The athletic trainer is not also the health teacher or the science teacher or whatever, but that's been a process. But there are other avenues, you know, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing. You know, do I wish that everybody would just hire athletic trainers as athletic trainers? I do. But there's other ways to leverage a school district. You talk about, hey, we can teach, yeah, you have sports medicine curriculum through TSATA, what have you, but there's also career technology pathways that are tied to money. And when a course like that can fund a position, there's people listen, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And school districts actually generate revenue based on those courses if they code them correctly.
You know, the other thing, Scott, that you bring up about the value of the athletic trainer, the way that the healthcare model is moving now, it's really moving towards population health. And right. The athletic trainer, that first practice domain, injury and illness prevention and wellness protection, that's really population health. And so if you take a high school athletic trainer and you talk about value added, and let's expand even more. Let's talk about how that athletic trainer can impact the nutrition of the entire school, the nutrition, the nutrition of all the students. Students are, eating better. They're feeling better. They're able to perform better in school. Those are higher test scores. Those are increased funding opportunities for the schools. So these are all these different things that the athletic trainer brings. And again, going back to that administrative contract and the fact that you guys have so many, it sounds like it's just a really functional, very healthy organization. And I think that you said what I think is most important. It's a process, and it's going to take time. So you've been there for how long?
Well, cumulative, about 17 years.
Yeah, and so it's taken that time to start on one path, and you left for a little bit, and you came back, and you kept building, kept expanding, right? Yeah. So this isn't going to happen overnight. And for the young clinicians that are listening, those that just came out of school or those that are coming out of school, don't expect to walk into a scenario the way that Scott has described it. You're going to have have some long-range goals, right? Just like in rehab, we have short-term goals and we have long-term goals. So these are long-range goals. This is where I am and this is where I want to go. And how do I start to build these relationships? And how do I create what's called strategic partners? The more people I have a chance to get in front of and talk about the profession, talk about what we add, talk about return on investment, talk about value, talk about decreased liability, talk about population health, the more I can expand, the more successful I'm going to be, because I've got more people that are buying into what we're about.
And see, the thing that for me, we have very few athletic trainers who are sitting in administrative roles across large districts. So, I think Katy may have one, Dallas ISD may have one. But the question for me was always, what are those people in those positions doing? Are they occupying these leadership roles? Are they just survivors? That's all about them, because they want that job. There's not only a few of those, or are they being advocates to help grow, And so, last week I went and met with the chief human capital management or executive director of human capital management for Dallas ISD, Dallas ISD, and Houston ISD, these big ISDs, you would think, they would be doing some great things, but Dallas just hired an athletic trainer for the first time a couple of years ago at all their campuses. And they thought that was a great accomplishment. And it was. But you have 6A Dallas Skyline with 6,000 students with one athletic trainer. And then you have 3A Dallas Molina with 800.
Hang on, back up. 6,000 students.
Yeah.
One athletic trainer.
Yeah.
And that was just this year, right? So go ahead.
Yeah, it was 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, before they didn't have any athletic trainers. They were just stadium based. And so while what they did was great, we have to keep moving forward, or if we just band-aid the problem. So people locally have up here, there's some people with middle school athletic trainers, but yet they only have two athletic trainers at their high school and they have one athletic trainer at the middle school and they have three middle schools. Well, that person is just a go-between, and sometimes I think school districts think, well, we'll just hire somebody and we just need somebody. We just need quote unquote coverage. We need that quote decreased liability. And they think coverage does that. And what I would implore everybody to think about is, let's talk less about coverage and more about care, and as well as I do, if you've been a PRN athletic trainer or covered any events, there's no relationships made. There's no, typically, you give an ice bag, you refer somebody maybe to their physician and have a nice day, and you have mitigated liability for that organization, but there's no relationship made. And that's what grows our profession. That's what will grow you in Pasadena, you know, long-term, are those relationships. It's a relationship business, in my opinion. And I think that's the part that athletic has to get into athletic training education is how do we build strategic relationships, like Josh said, strategic partnerships. And the key word in all of that is strategy. And sometimes, you know, in athletic training, we've lost that part. And part of it is everybody's so busy just doing their job. And so it is going to take people being self-advocates, self-promoters, self-starters, sacrifice. But, you know, I know people like myself and there's other people out there. I know Josh is a good one. Chris is a good one down there in Pearland who are willing to be advocates and willing to lend a hand. You know, we all got to get involved and help each other.
All right. So let's go over some action steps, because I'm understanding it needs to be about how am I going to provide quality care? How is this going to help you at the principal level? And then I need to know who's above him and how is this going to help you and how's it going to help you? So I am not a politician. People would see me as not kind because I took care of my business and I did just me. I just took care of me and that was it. I wasn't worried about everything else that was going on. But now I'm realizing, hey, there's a much bigger world. And when I meet with those people, when I talk with those people, it really benefits me. And it may be 2, 5, 10 years from now that benefits me, just that one relationship. But how do I go about that? How do I change that perspective?
Well, you know, for me, it's what I told, even just when we hired these new staff members, I said, you know, they need to notice when the athletic trainer is not there. You know what I'm saying? So there needs to be a difference when you're at an event versus when you're not, whether that's, you know, being visible, being seen, who you talk to, you know, it's that value that you're bringing. What is it that, you know, that you have athletic trainers who show up to events and you would never know who they are or where they are because maybe they're, you know, there's a game in the gym and they're still sitting in their office, you know, or there's five coaches sitting there and they all look the same because the athletic trainer looks the same, you know. I mean, I go as far as to intentionally dress a little bit different.
Good for you.
You know, not that my coaches dress bad, but, you know, if they're wearing green, I'm going to wear black. Or if they're wearing white, I find out. I make a conscious decision to make sure people know, oh, that's this group. They're not with this group, you know. You know, every injury that we evaluate, we send home written communication about. Good. You know, that can be tedious. That's a problem. I get it. But it helps introduce families and kids to the profession and to what's going on when they get it's, you know, and we have surfaces, everything's electronic. And so we just click, 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 and we hit print and things air print to a printer and we hand it to them and they take it home. And yeah, I didn't probably need to tell them about that bruised arm, but they get to see my name, they get to see my credentials, and they get to read a little paragraph about here's who is caring for your kids. And if you have, and it eventually, over time, the repeated exposure, you know, helps put it in people's minds. Hey, there's an athletic trainer. These people are on that campus taking care of my kid. And go as far as to send out, you know, we'll do a faculty, you know, once a month, we'll invite the faculty. Hey, if you have, you know, come over and get a free, you know, injury eval, or, you know, we try to do some things that build relationships and help people understand, give a, you know, send a presentation to your school board, or even through, you know, just some notes that they can read. Here's an update on the number of concussions we've had, you know, during football season, you know, just things that put your name and your information in front of people so that they always remember, so that when you go to make that ask, you know, they've seen and heard from you before.
Yeah, I love this information, Jeremy, from Scott, because what he is representing, again, it goes back to progress and innovation. It goes to strategy, long-term goals. And he just capitalized on something. He talked about something about, you know, making sure that people understand who the athletic trainer is and what that person does. And I love the fact that you go as far, Scott, as to separate yourself from, you know, appearance, right? And, you know, Chris Shattuck down here, we actually have created something called #ShattuckSharp, because Chris is always the best dressed guy in the room. And I he'll kind of grin at it, but I really place a lot of value on that. He's one of our preceptors, and through just example, he makes everybody better. And I have to tell you, one of the best places I think for athletic trainers to work on these appearances, to work on professionalism, is within our own communities. And so when I see athletic trainers that are at, you know, for instance, this, here in Houston, the Sports Medicine Update, or when I see athletic trainers that are, you know, at SWATA or NATA or whatever it is, and they're showing up to these professional conferences in shorts and a t-shirt, come on, we can do better than this. This is a professional organization. This is your opportunity in a very safe environment to build your professionalism, to dress appropriately, to make sure that we're representing ourselves as medical professionals. And I think going back to one of the original conversations that Scott talked about was, you know, athletic trainers, we want more pay. We want, you know, less time. We want all these other things. Okay. We're going to have to, as a profession, follow our own complaints, right? You want more respect? Dress appropriately, communicate appropriately, represent yourself and your profession appropriately. You want more opportunities? The same. Communicate appropriately, dress appropriately. All those different things. What, you know, for the high school, for those athletic trainers in a high school setting, what would it be like if you saw your principal show up in a pair of gym shorts and a t-shirt? How does that reflect on the school? That principal is the face of that school. You are the face of medical care at that school. There needs to be, you know, some sort of accountability for that. And I'm not saying you show up in a suit and tie every day, but, you know, absolutely, dress appropriately. And I think what you said, Scott, when it comes to athletic training education, I agree with you. We don't do a very good job as a profession of preparing our leaders. And from, you know, obviously in this conversation, I'm representing athletic training education. And one of my, one of my concerns, I suppose, is that the program director, right? So there are 360 some odd programs in the country, accredited athletic training programs. There are 42,000 plus athletic trainers. So just do simple math. Each program has a program director. That's 360 some odd athletic trainers that are program directors. Divide that into 42,000. That's less than 1%. And that less than 1% is responsible for the 99 plus. And you know what? If that program director doesn't understand the business of what we're doing, if that program doesn't understand professional responsibility, ethics, if that program director doesn't understand everything that we're talking about now, how is that person going to relay all that information to the other 99% plus? So as a profession, we need to do a better job of preparing our leaders. And even in our own practice domains, we have four practice domains that are geared towards patient care, because that's what we are. We're healthcare providers. But that last practice domain, it's going to be changing soon. It was about, organizational health and well-being. Now it's going to go to healthcare administration and professional responsibility. And we need to do a better job of understanding that. And, you know, in most athletic training curriculums, we have one course that deals with the admin side and deals with leadership and all of these other things. And if you talk to, you know, especially people like Scott, Jeremy, you're doing the same thing. Our recent graduates, if I talk to them, I go, you know, the athletic training skills, right? The clinical skills are there, but it's how do we navigate these waters? How do we leverage our abilities? How do we promote our profession? How do we gain more resources? How do we network? How do we do all these other things? We can't teach that in the curriculum to the extent of where you're going to need to know it. This is time, you know, in the battlefield per se. But this is also about people going on and getting more advanced degrees in business. This is about people going on and going on to residency programs. A hospital system is a great organization to watch how value is perceived, to watch how return on investment is perceived, to watch how decreased liability. Learn from these people. Even if you don't want to spend any time in the hospital system, fine, but go and learn. And we need more continuing education hours towards this. We need to do a better job of educating our educators on this. We need to do a better job of communicating that, right? And the other thing I think we need to do too is that, unfortunately, I've said this now for the last few years, I think the athletic trainers biggest, I don't want to call him enemy, but the athletic trainer's biggest hurdle is the athletic trainer. It's because the profession is going through so many changes right now, right? I mean, let's even look at the entry-level master's degree. Oh, come on. This is a bad idea. No, it's not. If you really understand why we're doing it, it makes total sense. But like we talked about, Scott, change is hard.
Right.
People don't like change. It makes them uncomfortable. My answer is good, right? Let's go back to a simple principle in physiology, overload. The body has to adapt or it fails. The profession has to adapt or it will fail.
All right. Josh, I know that one time I sent you an email saying, you know, sometimes you rub people the wrong way because you are one of those
more
catalysts.
Times than not.
But it really has opened my eyes and helped me change. Chris Shattuck, I had him on the podcast because basically at SWATA, he told me, Jeremy, you dress like a slob. He didn't say that directly to me, but as his presentation, I was mad at him. But then I brought him on and it's like, you know what? I really do need to change the way I look. And so it's good. And I thank you. And I just want to make sure that publicly I say thank you for being the difference. So,
oh, thanks. It's nice of you to say. I don't get many compliments, but thank you.
And so one of the things that actually in a couple of weeks, I have one of our school board members coming over here because he's gone to Jesse to get rehab. And so Jesse over at Dowie has done some rehab and he's built that good relationship with one of our school board members. And so I'm going to have him on the podcast. We're going to be talking about that. And just like you're saying, Scott, and you're saying, Josh, getting my face in front of them, you know, we proposed taking a field trip to Disney, which didn't pan out, but I was in front of the school board presenting this idea and what we were doing for our kids. And so that's kind of the same concept is, hey, let me just get you here without me really asking you for anything yet because of what I'm hearing you say, Scott, or what I've heard you say, Josh, or what I heard Chris say. And so finding some of those opportunities. And again, whenever I really started to want to get care for the middle school athletes was when my brother-in-law was telling me about all these injuries they've had. And it wasn't so much about me and my hours and improving my situation as it was improving the situation for these kids because he really doesn't know how to deal with a, you know, tib fib fracture.
And he's a coach.
He's a coach.
And he shouldn't.
Right.
The coach shouldn't be. What is the, from a medical standpoint, the coach is a first responder.
That's it.
Something happens, call the athletic trainer. And if it's life and death, call 911 and initiate CPR. And, you know, until medical professionals can show up.
This was my thought. Again, one, I want to have an athletic trainer at each of the middle school campuses so that they can be, because we have 10, and I would love for them to be a strength and conditioning coach as well, because that would keep them out of the classroom and out of those extra duties, but it would also allow them to prevent injuries through proper weight training, through proper movement techniques, and right. then we go from there. And so they could also, like you said, advocate for proper nutrition for athletic competitions. They'd be assigned for the strength and conditioning coordinator for all sports, not just boys or girls. But if we set them up for success at the junior high level with lifting techniques, then they'll be more likely to do that properly and have less injuries by the time they get to high school and are bigger, faster, and stronger. They could properly handle all the physicals and properly manage the concussion return to play protocols, and then they could also begin to recruit and build student aid programs to feed into the high school. All right, does all that sound like a good sales pitch, kind of maybe to a principal?
No, I do. I think those are all good. They are all, for the most part, athletic or athletic training related, you know, and just to give you, just remember that not all principals like athletics, you know, and, or they had a bad experience as a kid. Maybe they're not athletes. Maybe they could give, they don't think there's any value in athletics. And so, you know, just remember, you know, like for our positions, for example, I originally proposed them as teaching positions because at the middle school level, I was concerned. I thought, I'm not going to get an athletic trainer only that doesn't have an academic assignment, especially when you're adding an FTE, you know. Well, you know, I had 78 applications and basically nobody had a teaching certificate. And, you know, you start going down this road of you're just having to make things up and take people, you know, you're changing your quality because of your, you know, they want them to teach this or teach that. And so I went back to these principals and I said, look, the truth is, athletic trainers are not going to school to be teachers. You're not making your nurse teach, you know, these courses.
Exactly.
And you know, kind of use the same thing that we've already discussed. And I started talking to them about things that the athletic trainer can do as a leader. I said, you know, athletic trainers are leaders. We're used to having to command a room. And you know, what about lunch duty? You know, do you have problems? What about mentoring students? You know, and we talked about developing the student program, but it was more about the mentoring. So I think what you're saying is fantastic. All of those things were in my presentation as well. But when it comes down to it, just be aware that there are principals who say, well, if it has anything to do with athletic, you know, well, I'm all about academics. You know, I'm an academic person, so I don't care about athletics. And so, you know, you might have to give in an area, you know, to get, you know. And again, I think getting all 10 of those middle school principals on board helps that one or two that may not understand athletics. You know, it helps. There's strength in numbers, you know, when you go to approach something. But I think you're on the right track.
You know, if I can add one more thing to that, administrators love metrics. They yes. love analytics. That's what they live off of.
All right, so what metrics are we looking for?
So, you know, obviously, when you look at metrics and talk about athletic training, one, in a traditional sense, right, how many injuries did we have? How many did we prevent? How many, you know, all those other things. Well, let's get at a higher level. Going back to what Scott was talking about, what about providing metrics on, was there a direct relationship between you know, the athletic trainer's ability to, I don't know, influence nutrition? Did we see an increase in test scores? Did we see a decrease in days lost because of sickness? You know, when it comes to physical activity, did we see a decrease in days lost because of injury in PE classes? I'm just brainstorming here. This is off the top of my head. When it comes to just basic, you know, if we talk about the occupational setting, teachers hurting themselves, custodial staff hurting themselves, the general school population, did we see a decrease in days lost because of stretching techniques, because of, right? All these different things that, again, coming full circle to what Scott talked about, adding value to the athletic trainer's role and not just having the athletic trainer treat the athletic population, but the athletic trainer treating the school population. Population health, first domain.
Scott, any other metrics that I should look at collecting?
Yeah, you know, I think, I don't know if I'd call it a metric, but, you know, with concussion being such a big deal that it is today, this idea of returning to learn or returning to academics.
Right.
You know, students are eligible. Oftentimes, students could be eligible for 504 accommodations at the campus level after returning post-concussion. And you're the only one that really knows that. You know what I'm saying? As the athletic trainer, you're the only one who can really build that bridge, hold the counselor's hand, hold the parent's hand, you know, and hold the student's hand and connect those dots. And so I used that as leverage as well to say, look, the last thing you want as an administrator is some type of special needs or special education conflict. You know, when a kid deserved accommodations, should have had accommodations, and it was not either recognized or given, because you want to talk about mitigating risk. When you get into,
once you start getting a 504 and ADA and all that other stuff, man, you are going down a wormhole if you don't know how to navigate that.
Yeah, and so those are big buzzwords for administrators. They probably spend more hours than we want to imagine being preached to about, you know, doing those things right, because there's so much red tape. And so you can be a part of that process too, and that solution. And that's an area that they have no expertise in, which is concussion.
Return to learn is on the rise. Scott, I'm glad you brought it up. It is, you know, we know about return to play, but return to learn is gaining a lot of traction right now. And like he said, reach out to, in Texas, LSSPs, everywhere else, school psychologists, right? LSSP and the school psychologist the same. But be able to reach out to those people and educate them, right? Create your own mini interprofessional education. Have conversations with the school nurse. Have conversations with the OT. Have conversations with all those people that revolve around the healthcare, right? Because they're going to be links to all of it. Just like Scott said, kid gets concussed. He's going to miss Monday, Tuesday, maybe misses the entire week because they're still having concussion-like symptoms. That's a 504, right? We need to be able to make accommodations.
And so, I think ultimately for you, Jeremy, it's, when, you know, especially with a school board member or a parent or an administrator, look, here's what we can do better for the kids. You know, here's what we can be better for the kids, not for me, not for you, but for the kids. You know, and ultimately, when you're doing things for the kids and because of the kids, it's ultimately hard for them to argue, you know, that, I mean, they can say no for many reasons, but it's harder to say no when something benefits children. It really does. And we know everything athletic trainers do benefit children, but sometimes we don't talk about it. We don't frame it in that context. You know, when we work less, we have less hours, it benefits the children because we're more focused the next day. Mm-hmm. But instead we just say, I'm tired, you know, instead of, hey, my evaluations are not where they could, I'm missing some things because I'm rushing through this evaluate. You know, I think it's how you frame it. I think if you can keep things framed in that context, you have the ability to do great. And then creating competition locally, you know, here's what, you know, Pasadena can be better than HISD, or, you know, we need to catch up to Katy or to Pearland, or, you know, whatever it may be. Let's, you know, let's have some pride also in who we are as PISD.
I've taken a lot of notes, and I'm sure I've misspelled more words than I've spelled correctly because I'm trying to type so fast.
We need to have more conversations about this.
Yes.
I'm telling you, I think this is the most important thing.
Yeah, and I tell college programs all the time, when I was chair of the Texas State Athletic Trainers Association, it was my goal to try to go share this message with college programs, to get in front of student groups. And so I've done that, like at A&M, because it's my alma mater, and some others, but you know, for whatever reason, I think people like myself, people like Josh, people like Chris, you know, because of our passion, and you too, Jeremy, even though you've not seen the change you want, you're trying to be a change agent. We need to go to these, you know, volunteer our time, go to these programs and be willing to kind of speak from a different perspective, because for Dr. Yellen to stand up and say it, you know, sometimes kids tune him out, whether he believes that or not. You
no,
know?
I believe it. I absolutely, I'm the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. My kids tune me out. And so sometimes it's helpful to hear the message repeated by somebody new from a different place. And so, you know, I'm always willing to go and to share the message. And we need to get this message on agendas at professional meetings.
Yeah.
You know, for other professionals. And, right. You know, while ACL reconstruction and functional rehab and dry needling is all very important, you know, if it's just the same group of us doing those same things all the time, we're not really growing our skill, but we're not growing the profession.
Scott, but yeah, before you go, last year I was asked to represent the Katy. I was honored to do it on this professional responsibility work group. Dr. Gretchen Schlaubach is the chair. Was the chair of this group. The NATA board of directors approved unanimously to move the Professional Responsibility Work Group, PRWG, to a standing committee, the Professional Responsibility Committee. And we are so excited about this. And so I was asked again by the Katy to represent the Katy as a Katy liaison on this. And I'm so excited about this committee because this is the first time that there is a Professional Responsibility Committee there for the profession. And we're going to talk about all these things. We're going to bring this to light. We're going to help the profession move and advance. It's so important. If you have a chance to look at Dr. Schlaubach's book, she wrote a professional responsibility and ethics book. Hmm. And she is a great expert in this area. There needs to be more conversations about this. People need to be able to approach this from a business standpoint. They need to be able to approach it from a legal liability standpoint, from a marketing and promotion standpoint, from a return on investment standpoint. And they need to be able to say exactly what Scott just brought up. That's awesome that I'm great at rehabbing an ACL or dry needling or manipulations or whatever it is, right? Whatever's happening now. But how do I use this, one, to advance the profession? How do I use this to influence how the profession's going to grow? And how do I use this to leverage my ability to gain more in what I'm doing? Because the more successful somebody like Scott is, Chris is, you are, the more successful the profession is. Right, because we can use you as examples. We can say, look, this was done, and look at the route that he took, and let's go and duplicate that.
Just to give you an idea, you know, here's my dry needling box, you know, that sits on my, you know, there's not a lot of people, even high schools, dry needling actively, you know, but the truth is, this is one of those great new tools that, you know, is kind of hit the market right, athletic trainers are getting involved in. But at the end of the day, you know, I think just what Josh is saying, doing those things or not, if I'm doing that, but nobody knows about it, you know, and I take pictures of that and share it. And, you know, you just, it's more about the message, I think, than necessarily the method, you know, because every athletic trainer has their own way of doing things. You know, we all don't tape the same. Some of us don't use modalities. Some of us use them differently, but you know, it's the message that we need to unify. We don't always have to be unified in our methods. I mean, they need to be evidence-based, right? But I think if we can get this message out, we'll all grow because of it.
All right, Scott, somebody wants to connect with you, find out more. How are they going to do that?
They can email me, scott.galloway@desotoisd.org. It's probably the best way. You know, my office number is 972-274-8289. You know, I like to think I'm a decent communicator, so I'll try to get back with them. And again, you know, this profession's my passion. I was a student athletic trainer, when you could use those words, back when I was in high school, growing up in Livingston, Texas, which is just north of you guys. So, you know, I've been, doesn't feel like I'm old, but I think I'm getting there. So,
an amazing conversation from a great leader in athletic training. Scott, thanks for joining us. Dr. Yellen, somebody wants to get a hold of you.
My email is jbyellen, Jack, B as in Bravo, Yellen, Yellen, at central.uh.edu. And my phone number, my office number is 713-743-5902. We have a fancy link system, so if you call my office phone and leave a message, it will email my computer, which then send me a message on either, I'm always connected, either on my iPhone, my iPad, my laptop at home, something will notify
deer me. Deer blind, you know.
Deer blind, right, Matrix Rabbit. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure to have your knowledge and your passion and your different perspectives than what we're used to, Josh. So I appreciate you coming in here. So again, I told you, it's not a slight. I mean, sometimes I don't agree with you and
that's
I think
fine.
You're wrong. All right. Well, last couple things. Definitely check out sportshealth.com/SMB where you can register win a gift card. Elizabeth Thomason over in Louisiana. She won a gift card from School Health for last month. So just register there and you get a chance to win because School Health is doing some really good things. They're my preferred provider for athletic equipment or for the sports medicine equipment. So check them out again, sportshealth.com/SMB. And then my buddy Robbie at Frio Hydration, I really believe, you know, his stuff is a little bit of expensive, but it's really good. We're really pleased with it. The kids love it. And so check them out, FrioHydration.com. Again, FrioHydration.com. And then make sure you mention the Sports Medicine Broadcast to get some special deals. Our website, SportsMedicineBroadcast.com. And this one is SportsMedicineBroadcast.com/decreased liability. If you want to see the show notes, on Twitter, I am Mr. Jeremy Jackson. So for Jeremy, Scott.
Bye, Scott.
All right, that is a wrap. You.